This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the Buick Enclave, the finest luxury crossover ever. Visit buick.gm.ca to see that where there's passion, there's beauty.
Hello, I'm Michael Enright. This is the Rewind Podcast. Rewind mines the gold from the CBC Radio Archives.
Today on the show, another in the documentaries from the Centerpoint feature of the program Sunday Morning. The Alaska Highway is one of the great adventure roads of North America. Every year, nearly 200,000 people travel the almost 2,500 kilometers between Dawson Creek, British Columbia, to Delta Junction, Alaska, via Whitehorse, Yukon. But the road wasn't built for the benefit of tourists who wanted to see some spectacular scenery and a lot of wildlife. In 1992, as the highway celebrated its 50th birthday, Sunday Morning traced its history. Here's Mary Lou Findlay.
It's a long one, down to around the 3-yard line. White Cup, they said, cutting up to his left and over the 10. Nice block there.
December 7th, 1941, the Second World War was still far away from most Americans. They had other things on their minds.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air. President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also...
Then Pearl Harbor. Suddenly the war was much closer. Americans began to worry about where the Japanese would attack next. One of the places they worried about was Alaska. Sparsely inhabited, hard to defend, and remote. The United States government decided it had to have a road to the north, pronto. And in no time, an army of American soldiers was on its way, backed by an even larger army of civilian workers. Their job was to build a military road from Dawson Creek in northern British Columbia through the Yukon to Fairbanks, Alaska. Nearly 2,500 kilometers of road through country as wild as any on the continent. The Japanese invasion never happened. The American invasion changed Canada's Northwest forever. Today on Centerpoint, Whitehorse producer Sarah Locke takes us along the trail of 42 to see how the Alaska Highway changed the lives of everyone in its path and of the men who built it.
There was no overland connection across the wilderness of northwestern Canada. Not even a trail. If our shipping lanes could be interrupted, Alaska might fall. The situation called for immediate action.
The last time Bob Orenbrek and Jim Muncy were here, it was 1942, and you couldn't have called the road in front of them a highway. It was a muddy track that you could barely drive over in a Jeep.
Oh, there we are.
Yeah. That ridge in there is just on the... up above where the bridge was. And one day, Sergeant Peterson and I took off, walked clear up to the top of the ridge, and there was somebody panhandled for gold in one of those creeks.
I knew I was going to be surprised coming back. I'm glad that I'm alive to make it back, and I'm glad that my Heavenly Father let me live this long to come back to see something I'd done years ago.
Well, now it seems like just a regular tourist highway. And it makes you feel kind of proud to think that you, in a small way, worked on the last section of the longest highway in the world.
50 years ago, Bob Orenbrek and Jim Muncy were young soldiers with the 18th Engineers, one of seven regiments that helped build this road. They were headed north to Alaska, setting off on the adventure of their lives. In all, about 10,000 American soldiers helped push this military road through the bush. They outnumbered the people living in Canada's northwest nearly 2-1. Nothing much had happened in this part of the North since the Klondike Gold Rush in 1898. The country was still very wild. People traveled by boat or horse or on foot. Even if you had a car, there was nowhere to drive it. It was a quiet corner of the world until the American Army arrived with its graders and bulldozers. The road the soldiers built jolted the North into the 20th century, and most Northerners welcomed the change. Now they could drive to the outside world. Ken Coates is now a history professor at the University of Victoria. He grew up in the Yukon and took summer jobs working on the highway. His lifelong passion for the road shows in the two books he's written about it. When he looks back to 1942, he doesn't think that Canada had much enthusiasm for the Alaska Highway.
I don't think there's much doubt at all that the Canadians, first off, did not see the project as being all that worthwhile. One politician referred to it as a dubious egg, one civil servant referred to it as a dubious egg, and another one said it was a white elephant, destined ahead of time to be a white elephant. You see the Canadian government saying, basically, we are not going to build this highway, nor are we going to stand in the way if you want to build it. The Americans were, in fact, very keen at the highest level. They wanted to build the highway.
And they wanted to build it fast. In fact, American engineers were already on the ground in the Canadian North looking for a route before there was a formal agreement with Canada. Just months after Pearl Harbor, the American Army had its battle plan. The road would connect a string of airfields already being built between Edmonton and Fairbanks, Alaska. The conventional wisdom has it that the road was built to defend Alaska. Ken Coates challenges that idea.
The highway was a very expensive supply route to service a small number of airfields. When the proposal first came up early in 1942, the United States Army was asked its opinion and said, well, it's really not a very good idea. The U.S. Navy was asked its opinion. They said, well, a highway is not a really good idea. And the rationale is very simple when you think about it. Most Alaskans lived along the coast. Most of the places that were vulnerable were along the coast. The construction of a highway from Edmonton, Alberta, to Fairbanks did not solve the problem of the Alaskans living along the coast. And at least in small measure, one of the reasons for building the Alaska Highway was to provide assurances to North Americans that their territory was being defended. It was a public relations move. And you can see that in no other, in a very simple way, that there was a tremendous amount of mythology that surrounded it. This great excitement about the pioneers and about the Army engineers and the Corps of Engineers rambling up against the subarctic wilderness and beating back the permafrost and conquering mountain ranges and fording mighty rivers. And the tremendous enthusiasm across North America for that image has clearly made it very clear that North Americans saw this as a desperate race against a dangerous enemy in an absolute necessary move to protect North America from this tremendous threat.
The idea of a road to the North was not new. For decades, people have been dreaming of a way to exploit the vast resources of the region. Now, the American government was determined to make the road happen.
Diary of the 18th Engineers Combat Regiment, compiled by Fred Rust, regimental historian. We arrived in Whitehorse in April 1942. Our arrival was well-timed for tackling the job, but when we lined up to receive winter clothing, including fur-lined parkas, as the days grew balmy, we wondered whether the big shots had lost their minds. Our bewilderment increased when we began to attack the road coolie fashion, mucking around in rivers of mud, getting nowhere. On the day the first Caterpillar, a D-8 angle dozer, roared into camp, we began to understand. This was our first look at the monster of its type. And to run it, we had grocery clerks, fruit pickers, able seamen, and cowpunchers, with a bespectacled schoolteacher thrown in.
But even as this army of amateurs was firing up its bulldozers, the surveyors were still trying to figure out where to build the road, and that was not easy. In places, they could follow wagon trails or rough tracks. But for nearly 1,000 kilometers of the route, there were no trails and no decent maps. The basic direction was chosen by flying over the area in an airplane. But surveyors still had to pick a line on the ground, and that meant fighting their way through the bush and endless stretches of muskeg and mosquitoes.
You swear and swat, but they keep coming. Yukon mosquitoes are stormtroopers. Lieutenant Solderbeck was inspecting his rifle and jumped a foot when he saw something coming at him through the barrel. after the devils attacked us day and night for 2 solid months. Some of us experienced hysteria and the impulse to lie in the cot and cry.
And the funny part about the mosquitoes, as I remember it anyhow, was, I think in April, I know we'd get them, and when we would we'd get kind of cold at night, the mosquitoes would cease to operate. But as soon as the sun came up, away they go again. And of course, we did have the mosquito bars.
Harry Workmeister, Tom Cherry, and Gene Telgman were also with the 18th Engineers. 50 years ago, the mosquitoes were no laughing matter for any of them. But now the bites are forgotten, and the stories just get better with each telling.
The cooks, you know, they would be cooking stuff on there, and the mosquitoes were right in the pan with the food.
McPherson, he was a cook, and when he was beating the batter, making hot cakes like that, and a million mosquitoes zooming around, he would catch him with the spoon. And, of course, then we was eating the hot cakes. It looked like little caraway seeds in the hot cakes. And we says, well, at least we're getting fresh meat, you know. But that is our hot cakes with little caraway seeds in them, was mosquitoes.
I said, if you swatted somebody on the back with your hand, your whole handprint would be on his back because mosquitoes were that thick.
They could complain if they wanted to, but there wasn't anybody to complain to. They could run off if they wanted to run off, but there wasn't any place to run to. They were there.
Walter H. Parsons, Jr. was a captain with one of the regiments on the highway. He did worry about the morale of his men, but he had a road to build, and like most everyone in the Army, he wasn't quite sure how to go about it.
We just didn't know what we were doing. We got stopped at the river because we couldn't cross the Tanana, and we had to build barges and things to get across. And while we were camping there and getting ready to cross the river, this contractor came up and started his portion of the road. Well, he was a road-building contractor, and so we watched him, and saw how he operated, and we reorganized the regiment. At that point, we just reorganized the same as the contractor was. We never had any equipment like this in Florida. These boys didn't know how to run a bulldozer or use a grader.
My name is Jack Baker. I was sitting one day outside my cabin at Watson Lake, and I heard a crashing noise in the bush, and I wondered what on earth that could be. I thought first when I heard it there was maybe some moose fighting, but it was the wrong time of the season for moose. But then I realized that it couldn't be moose, there had to be something else. So I got in my boat, went across the little bay, and walked through the bush towards where this noise was coming from. It was getting louder and louder. All of a sudden, there it was. It was a bulldozer with an operator. And I was so astonished, my mouth must have fallen open when I saw this thing, because I'd never seen a big earth-moving tractor before.
In those days, people in the Yukon knew everything about everyone. There were no secrets, at least among themselves. Pearl Keenan lived in the village of Teslin when the highway came through.
I had dogs. I had 5 dogs that I went every place with, because I run a dog team, because that was our only transportation at that time, is dog team. So I walked up along the shore, and all of a sudden I heard this yelling. And it was really surprising to me, because all the people of Teslin were all out on their trap lines. And the only people that were there were the RCMP and the 2 storekeepers and the priest. And I knew there shouldn't be anybody down there. And I seen these heads peeking out over the lake, so I just took off down the lake because I didn't know who it was. And then I got up to Teslin. I got into Teslin, and I seen Robert McCleary. And that's when Robert told me, he says, apparently, he says, do you see what's happening? He was an Irishman. And he says, they're building a highway.
And I'll show you some of the spots along as we...
And we didn't have signs to stop for school children.
No, in their grocery stores.
Yeah.
I don't remember seeing these mountains you have here, big ones, or the big white ones, because we were always out in the bush and the timber, and we couldn't see very far sideways. And when they started out with two, sometimes three bulldozers abreast, just knock the stuff, knock the trees flat, run over them, leave them there for matting underneath, and then the dump truck come along, pull gravel on top. I don't remember this bridge. This is a better bridge than we built.
A D8 bulldozer mastering a big tree is a dramatic sight. The construction of a culvert, on the other hand, fails to make your hair stand on end. Long days of rugged labor were put in by duty soldiers up to their knees in mud, or swinging an axe at trees. An hour after a tree was chopped down, it was part of a bridge or culvert. Large trees were thrown aside. Smaller ones were laid together like an endless carpet of Christmas trees to provide a base for gravel. This was our corduroy road.
The soldiers were pressing ahead as fast as they could. During the summer, the long northern days meant they could work practically around the clock. But the Japanese were moving ahead as well. In June of 1942, the Japanese bombed Dutch Harbor and the Aleutian Islands off the northwest coast of Alaska. The American army had a continent to defend, and nothing could stop it. That included the people who lived in the area. If a native village was in the way, too bad.
See, that's where the road used to come down right there. Right along there, and go right along by the building and the other end of the barn. That's the main wagon road. Then when the army came, well, they put the right-of-way through there, see? It was just trucks after trucks going by the door there. There was no road out here then. They used to go right by the door.
Right by your front door?
Yeah, right by the front door. It was just, I don't know, it was just something new.
Sue Van Bibber is an elder with the Champaign-Asiac First Nation. She's lived in Champaign, Yukon for most of her life. In 1942, before the road came through, the community was a hub for the people in the area. They came from all over for the annual rodeo, and the store she ran was a going concern. Champaign was a center for her people, but for the American Army, it was something to get through, and her brother's cabin just happened to be in the way.
This cabin here? That one? No, they just wanted to destroy it, take it out of there, and we said no. So they just left it, put the road around it.
But barely. It's no surprise that no one lives here today. How far away is the road right there?
Gee, I wouldn't know. How far? Yeah, it's about, you say, 10, 15 feet to the highway, yeah.
The army kept moving north, but the native way of life had been changed forever. Champaign almost disappeared after the road was built. People moved away to places like Whitehorse, where there were jobs now and their kids could go to school. It seemed like they had more choices, but that's only if you accepted the changes.
You know, you have to admit it is a good life, because there was nobody was in a rush. No motors or airplanes or stuff like that. He didn't hear none of that noise.
Harry Dickey lives in Fort Nelson in northern British Columbia. Many native people took jobs working on the highway. In the early stages, they played an important role as guides for the survey parties. Later, some of them earned good wages working with the road crews. But Harry Dickey wasn't interested in these new opportunities.
Not me, no. I was not interested in working for wages. I was satisfied with what I was doing. Not because we're lazy, we didn't want to work, it just didn't happen.
Like just about every native person at that time, he was a trapper, and he loved it. But the highway brought changes here, too. Now it was easier for Indian agents to check up on people. There were new rules to follow, like registering your trap line. There was also more competition from white trappers who moved into the area along with the highway.
If an Indian trap line was vacated for some reason, somebody died, or the head of the family died, or someone, and the trap line would lay vacated, the game department would put the white man trap line free, never even paying 5 cents to anybody.
Harry Dickey was a young man when the soldiers first arrived. Ron Chambers' memories of the road are those of a wide-eyed young boy.
As a small child, I can remember all these soldiers coming through and rows of these caravans of trucks coming. And I used to be a bit of a camp rat when they came through. I wasn't too shy about these guys, and I'd go and see the camp, and I'd end up with chocolate bars and all kinds of things. These guys were neat to hit up. They were glad to see, you know, local kids and whatnot. And I was really intrigued by some of the black guys because I'd never seen black people before. And, man, you know, I'd never seen really pictures of them either, but it was quite exciting for a young person on a road like that.
Ron Chambers never saw the Yukon without a road slicing through it. But like many Native people, he knows that the road has made a hard life easier. Who wanted to bother traveling by dog team or horse when you could fill up your gas tank and drive? But these changes came fast, and they also came with a price.
Over there is some of our family. See, my mother is over there, and my stepfather, and some of my grandchildren. And
some of the graves belong to the unintended victims of the highway. The soldiers and road crews brought diseases new to the Native people, measles and influenza and chicken pox, diseases they couldn't fight.
A lot of them died then, and it wiped quite a few of the old people, too, all over, I guess. Sure, they know where it come from, because they were all disappointed about it, because they were losing their families, and I guess they were feeling bad, and they were blaming the army, all right. They were blaming the people for coming in.
I remember sick for 3 days. The whole village got sick. Within 3-4 days, the whole village was down. That's the flu of 1942. And that's the year I lost my first wife. She died on one night. Her grandmother, grandfather, and aunt died within 2 days. We knew they had to bury four of them in the group. That was the flu of 1942.
The highway was a transmission line for all of these new diseases, and every Native cemetery along the way tells the same story. This year, Northerners all along the highway are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the road. Many Native people are joining in on the festivities, but not all of them.
Hi, my name is Mary Jane Jim. My Indian name is Dakwa'al, or Najetnjia. Certainly there are people out there who are celebrating right now, but I think that with all respect, they should remember that there are people also that are grieving. There's a great deal of reluctance from our elders in the communities, especially those ones along the highway, that will not publicly discuss any of the loss that took place. And eventually, because of this celebration, I think that you're going to see an escalation of people dealing with that loss and that grief.
The soldiers were pushing ahead with their pioneer road, often so quickly that they ended up far in front of their supply lines.
No, our food supply was C and A rations, and once in a while the Canadian government would let us take a hunting party out and get a moose or a caribou or a mountain goat or...
There's no doubt that a meal of fresh meat was a welcome relief from Spam and corned beef. In the Yukon, the soldiers were allowed to have hunting licenses. They were just supposed to hunt to put food on the table. You still hear stories that they did more than that, stories of gun-crazy soldiers shooting at anything that moved. But there's no real proof that this happened, and when you ask highway veterans about their hunting trips, they usually talk about the one that got away or scared them away.
We were on a hunting trip, and we got pretty high country. And we were coming close to a, which we didn't know at the time, but we could see over there a little ways, 100 yards or so, looked like a little fire. And as we got closer to it, well, we could see that it was a berry patch, and there was snow, and it was bitter cold, but this was leftover berries. And as we got closer to it, we could see that it was a bear dropping, and that was steaming. And the size of that dropping, Buckles looked at me and I looked at him, and we says, any animal that does a pile like that, we don't want to meet. And we figured he's that close that it's still steaming. So we just backed, kind of back the way we went, and took off and forgot about the animal.
Canada seemed totally unconcerned with what was happening in the north. And the Americans weren't just building a road. They built telephone lines, pipelines, they even built a refinery so that they could supply their trucks and planes with fuel. The only person who got excited about what was happening in the area was the British High Commissioner to Canada. After Malcolm MacDonald toured the North in 1942, he wrote frantic letters to Ottawa about long-term American designs on the area. Canada had a typically Canadian response. A commission was appointed to study the problem, but nearly everything had been built by then. Highway historian Ken Coates says this sort of infringement on sovereignty wasn't unusual for wartime, but it's still surprising.
But what you do see during the Second World War is the massive, peaceful, friendly, allied occupation of the Canadian Northwest. Because if you look back on it from 50 years ago, from 50 years' perspective, and say, what happened? Well, what happened is simple. You've got 40,000, 50,000 American soldiers running around the Canadian Northwest, building roads, building airfields, building pipelines, putting up telephone lines, and not asking for permission, not getting things judged by any Canadian officials. And you look on the surface and say, wow, what an amazing surrender of control and sovereignty over your territory.
Walter Parsons helped build both the road and the refinery. He's not surprised that Canadians might have had some concerns.
There were more Americans in Whitehorse than there were Canadians when we were there. And we acted like it was our own. We didn't care about the Canadian Mounted Police or anything like that, but and they didn't bother us. And I can understand that. I mean, there was a war going on, and we were busy. We were busy building stuff there.
And to give the American Army credit, they were trying to build all of this stuff during one of the coldest winters on record. Even people who grew up in the North remember the winter of 1942 as a bad one.
55, 60, finally 70 below. Trees froze to their hearts. Trucks nearly immobilized. A few faithful D-8 bulldozers crawled to the northernmost camps where rations were badly needed. Almost half the regiment was still living in tents.
You would wash your hands and clothes, you know, inside right the thing there, and you take the dishwater and throw it out the thing, and there'd crack right in dead air. They'd go right into ice. Now, that's got to be cold. And when it comes to take the tents down, now, this is hard to believe, but when you come to take the tents down, you could pull that pole out of the middle, and the tent would just stay up there. It would just froze up there. Do you remember that?
And you would eat as fast as you can, because if you delayed anything, everything would freeze on you. And you'd stand as close to a fire. We had fires built all around, and we'd stand as close to the fire as we could and eat as fast as we could and dip our mess kit into boiling water and then run like mad for our tent. At night, when we would go to sleep in our sleeping bags, we would cover everything except our nose. The only thing I exposed was our nose, but we'd wake up in the morning and it'd be a crust of ice, maybe an inch or so thick, covering your nose and covering it there, and we'd have to chip that off before we could unzip our sleeping bag and get out of it.
And that was a difficult thing, too, about having black troops. A white man's nose turns white, I mean, gets, you know, different color there, and you can tell it's freezing, see? But a black man, he doesn't change. His ear will freeze off, and it never changed color, you know.
I want you to meet Corporal James Johnson, who is one of the most important men in a Negro regiment on the Alkin Highway. He is the cook. Tell me, Corporal, what do the Negroes up here in the frozen north like to eat best?
I like beefsteak and onions and hash brown gravy.
And how many times do you give them that?
5 times a month.
And what's their second favorite dish?
Beef and onions.
I see, and when do they get that?
5 times a month.
You were a cook before you got in the Army, were you?
Yes, sir.
Where did you used to cook?
Clifton Forge, Virginia, at Clifton Forge Hospital.
Is that your hometown?
No, sir. My home's Norfolk, Virginia.
Have you ever been in such a cold climate before?
No, sirree. No, sir.
A third of the troops who built the highway were black soldiers. Their officers were all white, except for the chaplains. At the start of the war, these soldiers were used mainly for pick-and-shovel work. Some found it hard to defend this sort of democracy. Joseph Haskin was one of the black soldiers who worked on the highway.
The treatment we got while we were there, while I was in service, was barbaric to me. You know, we were confined to the camp area. They didn't want the blacks to mingle with white women. That was the whole thing. And that's the way it was. You know, like the man said about Death Valley days, he said, and that's the way it was.
Segregation began to break down as the war rolled on, but many of the black soldiers still remember how they were treated while they were working on the highway. Edward Carroll was a chaplain with one of the black regiments. He remembers not being allowed to eat in the officer's mess tent when he first arrived in the North. Even 50 years later, he's still looking for the pat on the back his men never got. He wants the American Army to make amends.
To apologize for the lack of publicity for the 34% of the 10,000 troops who contributed to the building of a road. And certainly special thanks is due Afro-Americans who prove loyalty by responding to vigorous assignment in spite of belief that they lacked fortitude to withstand 50 below zero weather and other rigors on body and soul.
The Pioneer Road was known as the Alcan Highway at first. It was dubbed the Alaska Highway later. The American Army had spent about $140 million building its road to the north, nearly double what they thought it would cost.
You were the first man to drive over the Alcan Highway.
Yes, that's right. It was nothing much, really, but I'm proud of having made the trip. It took actually 71 hours of driving time.
Well, Corporal, what kind of a journey did you have? I guess it was pretty rough because the road was hardly finished then.
Yes, it was kind of rough. At mile 196, our fender fell off. That was due to the bumping around that the truck was getting. We drove for 20 miles through nothing but a sea of mud. The mud was so deep that our exhaust pipe was under it and our exhaust came out in bubbles. We drove in second gear through all that 20 miles of mud, but second gear on this truck would be the same as first gear in an ordinary truck. Two big six-wheel drive trucks which tried to help us got stuck too. I walked half a mile down the road and got a wrecker who hauled us out with a winch. Here's the funny thing. Just 10 miles outside of Whitehorse, we had our only flat tire.
This is our section.
Yeah.
On the north side of the Slims River, round Soldier's Summit. Someplace in here was the end of it. And you got to kind of pitch yourself to remember what it looked like with GI trucks coming down here with dust blowing up all around them. And all that activity don't seem like it's the same place at all. It just seems kind of unreal.
I've probably tooted my horn more on this job than anything in my life. And I've had 50 years to do it in.
Yeah. F Company was on the other side of the bridge. Yeah. We built about 800-900 feet of the road because of the bridge because we had the shallow side of the river. Mm-hmm. F Company made 200-300 feet on their side because the current was over there.
I'm back going to look at my map because I got it marked.
The 18th Engineers were officially credited with completing 272 miles of road and 28 miles of trail. We had broken in at least 150 heavy equipment operators and between 300 and 400 vehicle drivers. One officer and four enlisted men lost their lives during the mission. Private George Walters drowned. First Lieutenant Roland Small was found dead near his overturned Jeep, his spine broken. Technician Grade 5 John Morrison was walking his power shovel down a dip in the road. His chest was crushed when his equipment overturned. Private Gene Wolford was found paralyzed and semi-conscious beneath his Jeep. He later died. Sergeant George Miles died of a heart attack.
Early in 1943, only months after the Pioneer Road had been finished, the United States was losing interest in it. The Japanese were no longer a serious threat to Alaska, and the Army realized it was never going to use the road for hauling supplies. Highway historian Ken Coates.
They'd promised to build a proper civilian highway to full civilian standards, a proper country road. They were far short of that, and they stopped building. And what this meant was that on April 1st, 1946, they had an official handover ceremony. And here they were in Whitehorse gathering together and making all sorts of pronouncements about Canadian and American love for each other and this great exercise in cooperation and collective spirit and united effort against the ally and the enemies and what have you. Now, what did Canada get? What Canada got at the end of the Second World War was a highway that they seriously considered closing down. In fact, there was more than one American official who traveled the Alaska Highway in 1945 and 1946 and wrote back an internal memoranda that said, "We can't imagine that the Canadians will want to keep this highway going."
Retired Brigadier General Jeffrey Walsh was the Canadian officer handed control of the Alaska Highway when the Americans pulled out. He had his work cut out for him.
I had a terrible argument with my bridge engineer. I noticed that the bridges, I didn't think, were all seated properly. And he maintained that they were, because he'd been there with the Americans. He was a civilian. And he brought in the plan and so on and so forth. And I looked at the plan, and I just happened to glance down the corner, and they were designed for, I think it was zero weather, zero Fahrenheit. And, of course, we were getting 80 below zero, and, of course, the bridge jumped the rockers. And we had to, of any of the bridges that were built like that, we had to jack every one of them up and reset the rockers for the change in temperature. The plan had been designed down in Missouri.
50 years later, they're still rebuilding the road, and it's an expensive route to keep open.
Well, we're just cutting down part of the Steamboat Hill, just lowering the grade so they can, the trucks don't have as much trouble that way. They got most of it fixed now, but it's still probably the worst part of the Alaska Highway, I'd say, Steamboat. The B trains they got nowadays, they usually spin out here throughout the winter, eh? When it snows. They need better roads for that, eh? And that's what we're doing now, fixing the roads up. This particular piece right here is, it's only about a half a kilometer long, the piece that we're fixing. So it's not a very big job. Probably this little piece of road will probably cost them, $300,000, just for this short little piece that we did.
It costs about $25 million a year to maintain the 2,000 kilometers of the Alaska Highway that runs through Canada. That's about twice as expensive as a country road further south. It would probably cost less to maintain the highway today if it followed a different route. Ken Coates believes there are other reasons as well why a different route might have been better.
The most logical route, by far and away, would have made everybody's life easier, was the interior route. The coastal one was expensive as well. The one from Prince George, going north basically through Watson Lake to Dawson City to Fairbanks, would have made British Columbians happy, Yukoners happy, Alaskans happy. It would have been easier to build, easier to maintain, and it would have gone through the most heavily mineralized territory in the far northwest. But, of course, they weren't thinking about that. They were sitting there in February 1942 saying, "Quick, we've got to make up our decision. What are we going to do?" Well, the highway's got to follow the airfields. That's the decision we've taken. Having made that decision, they built the highway. Then, of course, Canada is saddled for 50 years with a highway that does by in no way follow the most advantageous route.
Today, the Alaska Highway is the adventure travel road in North America, the trip of a lifetime for people who want to see wilderness through their windshield. Nearly 200,000 tourists travel it every year. Some on bus tours, some on their own. Many choose to travel the road in recreational vehicles, like Marilyn, Tom, June, Bill, and Anne from New Jersey.
I think we've just heard so much about the highway, and it was sort of that
that feeling that, you know, you, that sort of, I'd still feel that, that pioneer spirit. So, I mean, the goal is Alaska. The goal is to get up to Alaska and see all the things that Alaska offers. But I think we saw it as the Alcan Highway as that the way to get there. I mean, because we're all old enough, you know, to go back to that period of time when it first came into existence, you know, and so we just view it as this special road that is not brand new, is not all four lanes or five lanes or eight lanes the way we have a New Jersey Turnpike, but rather would be something that would be a big adventure for us. We're told it's not a wilderness road, but it's a road through the wilderness.
What is wilderness to some is home to others. And some of the people who live on the most remote sections of the road are the lodge owners. Vivian Clark and her husband run a lodge in northern British Columbia.
When people do come in and say, "Boy, you're living in the middle of nowhere," I say to them, "What do you mean? This is Toad River." You know, to us, it isn't in the middle of nowhere. We realize that we are, you know, 400 miles from our nearest bread supplier, but we can also make our own.
The lodge owners regularly have to field complaints about the condition of the road. Vivian Clark has a standard response when that happens.
There are a lot of American people who travel up the highway that don't know the history of it. And sometimes they'll come in and say, "Boy, this road is something else," you know, and I'll just say, "Well, you ought to know, you guys built it," and they look at you as if, "What?"
Even 50 years later, driving the Alaska Highway can still be an adventure. Some road-weary travelers find they've taken on more than they've bargained for. Bill Schluter worked at the Fireside Lodge in the southern Yukon when he first came north. He's been collecting stories about victims of the road ever since.
And then we had one woman pull into Fireside there. She was headed south, and she asked if she came in looking rather frazzled. She had kids with her. Her husband was a military man, had gone out earlier, and she was coming out with the kids. Asked if the mountains were behind her now. And when we told her she hadn't got to them yet, she left her car there, took the kids back to Watson Lake on the bus, and flew out. And then during the summer, they came up, and they had their car shipped out that she left there. So that's how the road used to affect people. But she thought the mountains were behind her already, so.
Sometimes Bill Schluter's stories are more bizarre than funny. Occasionally, tourists drive in with a glassy expression that can mean trouble.
Here, a few years ago, we had a case where a fella in confusion and with what, and exhibiting what we call the 2,000-mile stare, chopped his toes off with an axe right here at the signpost so he wouldn't have to drive anymore. He was shipped out. He actually did. That's verifiable through the local hospital here. Pulled over at the signpost there, got out and took an axe and chopped the toes off of 1 foot. But the fella said he just couldn't take anymore. So, isn't that terrible?
Many people have called the Alcan project a miracle of engineering skill. But to anyone familiar with the job, this was just flowery exaggeration. Building the highway was not a miracle, nor was any great engineering skill needed. The mission was accomplished thanks to long, hard hours of work under the worst possible conditions. All possible credit for the task should go to the soldier in the field.
But, I mean, at least it achieved what it was, the propaganda virtue of it. As far as the Japanese was concerned, that highway was going like a Hummer, you know, during the war. We were really hauling supplies over it, but we weren't.
The Trail of 42, the building of the Alaska Highway, commemorated the 50th anniversary of the highway's construction. And that's Rewind for today. I hope you enjoyed the show. Rewind is produced by Marika Mayer. Please send us your thoughts. We love to hear from you. Our email address is radio1sirius@cbc.ca. That's radio1sirius, S-I-R-I-U-S, @cbc.ca. I'm Judy Madryn. Goodbye.
I'm Michael Enright, and I'll be back next week with a new episode of Rewind.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.